You're listening to Episode 7 of Season 7 of the GNU World Order. Yes, it is the GNU World Order. It is Episode 7. It is still Season 7. My name is Klaatu, and this is my little OG cast about technology and about GNU. Linux, Unix, and everything of that nature. In this episode, we're going to do a quick little review of the Usenix conference that I attended just last week, although by the time you hear this, it'll be 2 weeks ago. We'll talk about digital distribution, what it's like to send your content over the internet. Very exciting stuff. We'll talk about OwnCloud, and we'll round it off with a little bit of a discussion about where we should place our common files and backup schemes, and even an Acer Aspire BIOS recovery. So lots of stuff to cover. Let's jump right into it. Okay, enough of the music. So in this episode, we're going to talk about Usenix a little bit, because I attended Usenix 2 weeks ago now, and it was a really good conference, a really neat event. Of course, it's not called the Usenix conference, it's the LISA conference, the Large Installation Systems Administrator Technical Conference, or something like that. It was held in Boston, so I drove over to Boston, quite a long trip actually, lots of toll roads, but it was really fun, you know, to get out on the road, do a little bit of a road trip, a lot of fun, and I ended up in Boston, you know, about 12 hours later, and it was a beautiful city. It's a really nice place, and the conference itself was held in a Sheraton hotel, sort of in the very middle, the dead center of Boston, on Boylston at, I think, Dalton Street, something like that. So it was just kind of like in the dead center of the city. Really great location. This was the one conference where I actually spent quite a bit more time out in the surrounding city than I often do. A lot of times you go to a conference and you'd never know you were in a different city because you really don't experience the city that much. Which, I mean, typically is what you want. I mean, you're there for the conference, not the city. But this time I'd always been meaning to check out Boston. So it was kind of fun to get out and experience the city a little bit. Really, really sort of fun week-long vacation. And indeed, the conference is an entire week. It's insane. It's crazy. The conference is just, it's really, really huge. It's just really serious and large, and you've got a really diverse crowd. So if you've ever been to something like the Ohio Linux Fest or the Southeast Linux Fest, Southern California Linux Expo, and I'm sure it's probably the same for the Northwest and for the South, West, or whatever they call it down in Texas, or the Northeast Linux, GNU Linux Fest, or whatever. Those are very community-driven conferences. They are really put on by the local lugs, typically, or by a group of local lugs. And a lot of the people that they attract are enthusiasts, are people who want to get into GNU Linux, for either their small business or for their home. And that's kind of the set of people that you find at those conferences. To me, that's a lot of fun. I like that. I'm used to, like, my conference experience are essentially science fiction or fantasy conferences. So I'm used to going to a convention or a conference and finding a lot of people who are really, really into the subject matter for which they have congregated. I'm not saying that's not how it was at LISA. I will say that I wasn't as sociable at LISA because I didn't really know that many people at the other conferences that I've been to for the technology stuff. I've kind of known people from IRC. It was a little bit different here. I didn't know that many people. I'm sure I probably cheated myself out of meeting a lot of new and cool people. But I did meet some neat people. I mean, I met one of the lead developers for Nagios. He saw my t-shirt, which said Nagios on it, and he was like, hey, that's me. You're wearing my shirt. So that was cool. I met a really cool mathematics artist, representing the FSF. I saw FreeDeb formerly from the FSF, now from, Media Goblin and, the Python training thing that she's doing. I saw, David Nally, I guess I sort of knew him from Fedora before, and now he's with that cloud company. So, I mean, it's, you know, I saw a lot of people there who I kind of knew, and then I saw a lot of people that I I came to know over the course of the conference. I missed K5 Tux. I don't know how we couldn't find each other. It was really bizarre. But like I say, I was actually at this conference less consistently than other conferences because the city was so neat and I had friends there to visit. And so I wasn't just hanging around the hotel the entire time. All of that said, I mean, in terms of like the experience, the conference itself is just chock full of information. Incredible talks on actually a wider spectrum of things that I had anticipated. I thought large installation sysadmin, okay, this is going to be way over my head, out of my league. Turns out it wasn't. There were some things that I had no context for, or actually, I can't even say that. I'm going to say I had, now that I do a little bit of sysadmining for money, I will say that I have context. And the interesting thing about this sort of, really about Unix in general, I think, is that it scales so darned well. And I don't think I ever really understood what that meant, before really just doing the sysadmin stuff. And what you realize, and I think I had a modicum of this just as a Unix and Linux user, but it really hit home at this conference because I went in thinking, okay, this is all going to be over my head. I have no idea what's going on. I'm ready for that. And instead what I found was that I would show up and they'd be talking about something like a huge backup scheme with lots and lots of drives and an automated robot arm to change tapes or media discs or whatever. And, you know, how you've got to implement this for your Fortune 500 company. And it's not like they're talking another language. You can tell that it doesn't apply to where you are right now, but you could imagine it. You can say, okay, well, instead of like having a couple of petabytes of backup, I really only need like a terabyte or so. Don't need the robot arm, but I do need to know that I have some reliable solution in place with daily sets of backup, you know, and you start looking at different things, and you start looking at Amanda, you start looking at rsync in new and different ways, and how to use it differently, you know, all these different ideas that you suddenly have because you've heard about the way the big boys do it, and it actually starts to make sense, and it does apply. And this is kind of what I've been saying about Unix in general, and the whole Unix philosophy in a very generic sense, that the principles laid down for this really fantastic operating system apply to so much more than just the operating system. They apply to whole systems design, the way that you piece things together, and project management and project design, all that kind of stuff. And the same idea holds true for, well, really a lot of different aspects in life, but I'm just going to grab, like in the film world, when I tell people about assistant directors and what their job description is, and it turns out that assistant directors, very unglamorously, are, at least in pre-production, in charge of making schedules and budgets and things like that. And people tell me, well, yeah, I'm never going to hire an assistant director. I'm just not on that level. I'm never going to have that many people working on my project. And that might be true. That might be completely correct. You may never be at the level where you actually get an assistant director, but you need to know that the assistant director exists and what they're supposed to do so that you yourself can put on your assistant director hat and schedule your film, or budget it, or break your script down, or whatever you're doing that day that sort of makes you have the assistant director hat on. Same goes for something like Lisa. A lot of the things that they were talking about, I looked at and I thought, wow, I will never be at that level. I don't even want to be at that level. That would be a world that I would not have all that much interest in. I don't think I'd enjoy that on that size. But knowing that such things exist, and knowing that such issues exist, and how they deal with those things, and how they design their way around those issues, that's important, because on a smaller scale, one or two servers, like I have, well, I have more than that, but two main servers, and then a couple of backup servers, that sort of thing, you've got that in place. How do you manage them? There's no reason why you shouldn't manage it like a big, I don't know, you know, a big multi building network or whatever. So very, very important stuff. Very, very good information. Highly recommended if you can all at all get to Lisa. Next year it's in San Diego. So if you're on the West Coast, it will be there for you. You can go, you can attend and learn lots of stuff. It's not cheap unless you did what I did, which is volunteer for KDE. So I volunteered for KDE, met a great KDE promo member there, Algot Runman, no less. That's apparently his real name. And it was a lot of fun representing KDE, hearing about people's impressions and kind of like what they thought of KDE, whether they liked it, they didn't like it, they wanted KDE 3 back, they love KDE 4, they're looking at KDE again because GNOME 3 came out, now they hate GNOME, blah, blah, blah. It was a very, very mixed bag of experience at this conference. The booth was fantastic. I call him Rune now for some reason. Algot Runeman made all these kinds of do-it-yourself promotional materials. I mean, stickers with a little corner cutter that he got from Staples or something. Really cool stuff. A little a banner that he got printed out at an office supply store. Just fantastic, fantastic stuff. Really showed the power of just what a community, a random community member can do for a project that they really, really believe in. And that was really interesting and kind of made me think about the idea of contributing to projects. So let's talk about that for a moment. So it was Algot who said to someone, because someone had asked why we were there, who we were, why we were sitting at a KDE booth, especially since we both said that we were not KDE programmers, and Algot explained that he was there because he felt like contributing back to a project that had given him so much already, which... And that's kind of like the standard reason that many of us promote Linux and various projects of Linux. But for some reason, I don't know, it kind of made me think, maybe because I was sitting around doing nothing otherwise, but it kind of made me think about enthusiasm versus evangelism versus support versus, let's call it a pyramid scheme. My old OS, which I've vowed not to mention by name, my old OS encouraged evangelism and enthusiasm among its users. And at the time, I could get into the enthusiasm. I'm not really much of an evangelist in general, so can't really go out and like sell an OS to people. It's just not in me. It's not where my skills are. But if you ask me about something, I will naturally be fairly enthusiastic about it if I'm interested in it. So there was some of that with my old OS. And towards the end of my time with my old OS, before switching to GNU Linux, I started to notice that there was actually a corporate knowledge of the fact that they had people out there on the streets, in the businesses, in the homes, in the apartment buildings, who were actively promoting the product. And there was such a knowledge of that it was really something that they started to leverage. And that was kind of interesting to me, because it seemed to me like there was almost an interesting kind of reliance upon that. And I don't think I'm understating that at all. I don't think I'm overstating that. I might actually be understating it. The companies know what is going on out there. They know. I'm not saying they know because they're watching you or monitoring you via the Googles or anything. I'm just saying that they know. They're not stupid. They know that people are out there talking about their product, spreading the good news. And I even understand why people do it, because if you find a good good product that treats you well, you have two impulses. As human beings, we have generally the impulse to share what we've discovered, because when humans find something that's really neat that they really, really like, that's what they do. They share it with people. That's what they like to do. I don't really know why. It's just part of our nature. And that's the natural response. I found something really cool. Look at this. Let me show it to you as well. And you should get it. And it might really make your quality of life better, etc. The second thing is that people want that product to continue to be around. And people know that in order for a product to be around, the company itself needs to get business. So there's kind of a selfish, self-interest driving promotion. So if I find a really great piece of software, I certainly wouldn't want that software to just kind of die out and go away, so I'm going to tell lots of people about it. So those are the two reasons. The first, I think, is largely, I mean, that's just authentic. That's just how you feel about something, and you want to share it. There's not really a whole lot that can be done about that or should be done about that. That's neat. That's cool. That's all about sharing. The second thing has great potential for complete corruption, meaning that if a company knows that people are out there promoting their product, they're basically, especially if they encourage it, which of course they would because it's in their interest for people to promote their product, it's got great potential for being exploited by that company, and it's something that turns into essentially kind of a pyramid scheme, meaning that there's one guy at the top making a whole lot of money off of the continued efforts of people down at the bottom whose only real reward is that they continue to bring in paying customers. So they're paying to be in the club, and they're spreading the word of this club and encouraging other people to pay to get into the club. And those people who have just come in start paying into the club, and then they get their friends to be in the club so that they're paying. There's never really a return on this investment. It's not like you get to level up and stop paying. You always are paying, and you're bringing in all your friends who now have to pay. And that's just how it works. And the people at the very top of the pyramid are the ones raking in all that dough. And you feel like you're doing something because you're spreading this thing that you have fallen in love with. It feels good to share. You're also perpetuating the product that you like. You're ensuring its continued existence on the market. And so it just kind of, it works. It works out for you in that sense. But if you really look at it, you're really not contributing that much. You're just kind of, you're a marketing pawn, really. Whereas on free software, when you go out and talk about something that you like and you share something that you like, you're literally giving back to the project because now you're gaining users, you're gaining support for the platform, and the potential of them becoming real contributors, i.e. actually learning code and contributing code back, or becoming a bug tester and contributing bug reports, or joining up with a design team, or you know, whatever. I mean, it's a chance for, I guess, a more tangible investment, something where people are actually putting back into the project, and even Algot Runeman and myself sitting down at the KDE booth, spreading the word of KDE to a lot of people who already kind of know about KDE. Some people weren't all that clear on what it was, so it was kind of, like I said, it was a pretty mixed crowd there. And so you've got a pretty good sense of contributing back to the project because you're getting interest in it, you're getting people looking at it and possibly contributing back to it in some way. And there was, I mean, heck, there are even financial ways to contribute at this point. They've got Join the Game at KDE where you can literally become like a card-carrying KDE member. You send them some money, and you're in KDE as sort of a paying member. So you've got lots of different ways to contribute back to these projects that very directly give back to you. And it seems so much more participatory, so much more involved to be promoting something that you can then tangibly contribute back to, rather than simply become a mouthpiece for that product, not project, and tell everyone, hey, quick, throw more money at this thing so that I can continue to throw my money at this thing. And none of us are actually determining the outcome of this product. In fact, we might actively be screwed over by this product. It may go in a completely different direction than what we want, with no recourse, absolutely no recourse. And keep in mind, of course, that with free software, you do have that recourse, and there's proof positive that exists. I mean, especially, for instance, KDE 4, there's a group of people who don't like KDE 4. They have the Trinity Project. It's KDE3, and it's continuing to be developed. And if you just love KDE3, then you can install Trinity, and you can go down that path. Why anyone would do that, I don't know, but that's the strength of this whole GPL. You own the code. You can do whatever you want to with it. You contribute back. Other people can do what they want with it. It's a powerful, powerful model, and it's completely different than just being a salesperson for something that you will never, ever own or control. Just kind of an interesting point and counterpoint that I kind of thought of as I was sitting at the KDE booth. So, Usenix, Lisa, very, very cool. A lot of fun. Try to go next year if you want. It's in San Diego. If not, don't go. It's okay. There's lots of other conferences too. Weeks ago, I was taking just a day class on some internet stuff, HTML and CSS, and one of the people in the class was talking about putting photographs online because she was a photographer and wanted to sell photographs, and one of the places she felt was a pretty good market was the internet, and she kept having these concerns about, well, if I put the photos online, won't people be able to download them and steal them? And this came to a culmination, I guess, when the subject of Creative Commons was brought up in class. Not by me, by the way. It was literally something. Actually, you know what? It was on a photo sharing site, actually. That's why that came up in conversation. But the teacher of the class kind of knew that I was very much into Creative Commons and free stuff and all that kind of things, and so she had me say a couple of words about it, which I did really, really horribly, but the conversation had gotten started, and so this one person who was the photographer really started to freak out now, because here was the Creative Commons license, it's giving people permission, potentially, to reuse the photo, it's such a horrible thing, and doesn't that just make it so much easier for people to just take her photographs and run off with them and do whatever they want to? And I tried to explain to this photographer, this fine art photographer, that the Creative Commons license was actually an addition to copyright. There's the implicit copyright that she owns the photos anyway because she took them, so that's sort of an inborn and kind of also happens to be a legal, definable right. She owns that photograph. She's not giving that up when she applies a Creative Commons license to it, and in fact is even stating that if someone is going to use the photo, they need to give her credit for it. And she said, well, yes, but then they can use it. And I was like, well, yeah, they can use it anyway. It's online. You're putting it on the internet. All they have to do is grab the photo from the site, and they can do whatever they want. So all you're doing is stating, if you do that, then you must give me credit for it. She couldn't wrap her mind around this, and even the class teacher was trying to explain to her that if it's on the internet, then people can do whatever they want to with that image. It's just the nature of the internet. And this person was having a very hard time understanding the difference between having a photo online and I guess people being able to use it. I'm not really sure where the breach, the gap there was, but it just wasn't making sense to her. No matter how often the teacher of the class showed her, look, here's a screenshot, I just took your photograph, or how much I told her, I assured her that if she gives, you know, even me, and I'm no hacker, I mean, but you give me 5 minutes on the website, and I could probably find her photos if they're there for download. I could probably locate where they are, and I could get them. I could download them if I really wanted them. So the question of the Creative Commons thing, I mean, that, I think to you, my dear listeners, I think that's probably, I think we all understand that pretty well. And the fact that something's online and is therefore pretty much obtainable, by the general public is also pretty obvious and not that difficult for us to understand. Don't think I need to explain that or examine that idea, but I did want to examine the mindset, and I think perhaps that the internet is one thing, But I think that there are two different perspectives on this whole internet thing. And to a large degree, this is old news, but I'm kind of just now formulating it, I think, in a way that I can understand it. So the internet to you and me, and probably a lot of other people, is this place of community and being able to share your stuff, and it's very empowering, right? I mean, for computer geeks, what did it mean? Well, it meant suddenly we can code with each other from halfway across the globe, and suddenly we can, you know, build a kernel for a computer that will start up an operating system that we can then design to, like, this really, really rich experience. Okay, that obviously happened. It arguably would not have happened without the internet. To artists, of course, it's been profound, because now suddenly, I mean, it's been beyond profound. I don't even know how to express it in the English language, how profound it's been. But, you know, for artists, I mean, okay, here's my music, or here's my photo, or here's my digital art, or whatever. I can now post it online, and suddenly from my sort of inbuilt local community of maybe 50 people, or if you're really, really lucky, maybe 200 people, suddenly I get a potential of billions of people, you know, who could see my art now, whereas they really would have had no access to it previously. That's very, very powerful stuff. And it's so powerful that it's been, you know, a major, major shift in pretty much the entire industry. Obviously, we all know about the RCIAA or whatever they are called, that kind of shift. That's the bad shift for me. I'm talking about for the independent artist. It's a huge shift, because if you look at film schools and what they were teaching, I think probably even as early as the, or as late into, probably the 90s, maybe even later. I'm not really sure, because I haven't been teaching that long, but I mean, film schools have been teaching for as long as most people around me can remember, that if you were, for instance, a filmmaker, your career path, such as it is, was to try to get funding, which is impossible, and make a film, which is difficult, and then try to get it into a film festival or get it purchased by some distributor who can then put it onto the mass market and market it to some degree and get people to pay money for it. All of this is very, very difficult. The infrastructure just doesn't even really exist. It's not like the movie business started out saying, look, we're going to discover new talent and bring it to people and see if they like it. That's just not the way it works. They set big studios down, they develop scripts in-house, they shoot it in-house, and they literally owned the movie theaters back in classic Hollywood. The studios actually owned the theaters, so you couldn't go to just any theater to see the latest Cary Grant movie. You had to go to an MGM or whatever. I don't really know what studio he was affiliated with, but my point being, they literally owned everything from the conception of the movie to the delivery of the movie. It kind of shifted in the 70s and the 60s and the 50s, no, probably 60s and 70s after some antitrust stuff, but even so, it's not set up for, look, here's cool new independent stuff that you can enjoy. That's not how it is. It's about familiar names. It's about product that they could market. So the fact that for a filmmaker their only avenue was to just do this shot in the dark and just get the movie made and then try to get it out there into some form that people can see it by via film festivals or whatever, it was very dismal. That's no joke. I mean, it was very dismal. It was a horrible, there was no career to it whatsoever. But now, I mean, I literally have people in the class that I teach, a beginning filmmaking class, I literally have people sitting in the classroom, and I'll ask everyone why they're there and what they hope to learn from the class, that kind of thing. Literally have people saying things like, hey, I want to learn how to make a movie so I can have something on YouTube. And that's the goal. That's like their goal. And that's beautiful to me. That's so empowering, to use a horrible self-help kind of term. But really, it is, it's very empowering, because suddenly you've got just normal people, and all they want to do is learn enough of the professional level technique so that they can make a movie that satisfies their own, it scratches their own itch. You know, they want to produce something creative, and they just want to know kind of how to do that. And so they go to a film class, and suddenly by the end of a basic level course, they have made a short movie and they've posted it to YouTube, where all of their friends, and then some of their friends' friends, and then some random people on the internet can see the thing. And that's huge. That's so, so major. And as you can imagine, it's just so, so reviled by the traditional studios and even the traditional film festivals. Makes them quake in fear, really, and they really have to keep up their kind of front of, oh, well, we are really, really prestigious, and if you're just on YouTube, you're not as good as being in this festival or in this associated with this distribution company or whatever. And hopefully that's just going to kind of flounder and sort of slip away, and people are going to recognize that everyone can be as much of an artist as anyone else. So this is a huge deal, and that's what the internet has brought us. And this is, I guess, really, you know, to a large degree, why I'm even a geek today. Like, why I even care about computers at all. It's just because of how influential and how liberating they've been for normal everyday artists or programmers or writers, or, well, writers or artists, but, you know, just normal people. That's a big deal to me, at least. And that, to me, is what the internet is. And if we look at the internet as a project, which it is, because we're all building it, we're all making it, and it is, it's a huge open source project. We can all put stuff onto the internet, and it makes the internet what it is. We can decide what the internet is going to be. And it turns out, I think, that there's a certain fragment of people who, and I have in mind the quote-unquote types of people that these are, but it could just be a bias and blatant sort of stereotyping on my part. So I'm not going to assume who these people are, at least out loud. But it's these types of people, and they kind of have this, they see the internet and they say, wow, internet. I invest a little bit of time and money in an internet web page site, and I get in return a billion people in the audience, a billion potential audience members, or 2 billion, or whatever the number would be. That's a big deal. Seems like a really good investment. And so they do. They invest in knowing a little bit about how to get a website. They get some kind of domain, or they put something online, and they expect it to be, and they're looking at it as a marketplace. And so they bring their product, whether it's something that they're trying to sell, a non-artistic thing, or their art that they'd like to get some money from, they bring that to the internet and they post it, and then they want to restrict access to it. You know, they don't want people to be able to look at it without paying for it. They don't want people to be able to take a screenshot of their nice little photo, or they don't want people to be able to download their music. They just want people to be able to stream it, but you can't keep it. You have to go to the site and listen to it as it streams. Whatever. First of all, of course, there's their inherent complete lack of understanding of the technology. As you and I both know, that kind of restriction is very difficult to pull off in a very graceful, user-friendly way, and there's usually hacks around it in the end. They might not be pretty hacks, but there are hacks around it. It just all depends on how badly the person wants your stupid little piece of art, or your stupid picture, or whatever you're giving away or selling. I mean, if nothing else, you know, someone buys one copy and then posts a copy of that copy for other people to download. There are ways around it. The other thing is the inherent lack of understanding of the spirit of the internet. And they can try to force the internet into a Walmart department store mentality, where you get to come by and you get to take the box off the shelf and go to the cash register and purchase it, and you don't really get to experience it until after that time. But it's just not going to happen, because the internet is about open community and open sharing, and that's what it's going to be about. And if people try to convert it into something else, then they're completely permitted to try that. And in fact, I would go so far as to say, to invite them all to fork the internet and create their own internet. And they could call it MarketNet. And they can make it as restrictive against sharing of information as they possibly want to. And their audience will go right back down to the 25 people that they can talk to personally and say, hey, please go to my site and buy my stuff. And more power to them for that. That's great. If that's what they see for themselves in their online community, then I want them to be able to have that, because it's an open project. Everyone can make the internet into what they want. But that's what it's going to take. It's going to take them to fork it, because if people want to put their stuff on our internet, then they're going to have to accept that the internet is a place where things are shared, where things are available, where things are open, and they can go through whatever kind of hoops that they want to try to lock it down and try to restrict it, but that's not going to work. That's not what the internet's about. And if the internet ever becomes about that, then I'm going to fork the internet, and I'm going to make some other thing that we can all go to where it is open and sharing and something based on contribution and innovation and all that other good stuff. So that's my thoughts on digital distribution. Nothing groundbreaking, but it's something that I think I needed to say out to everyone, because that's something that we need to preserve on the internet. And I know that with the SOPA law and everything like that, at least here in the U.S., it was kind of, under attack, or whatever you want to say. But I don't know. I have faith in the internet. I think people are going to be able to keep it pure, keep it open, keep it about community, and keep it about, like I say, open innovation and freedom and stuff like that. So, speaking of that, let's talk about OwnCloud. Okay, admittedly, before we talk about OwnCloud, we should probably take a coffee break. So, go get yourself a cup of coffee, make it just how you like it, and enjoy it. I know I will. And then we'll come right back, talk about OwnCloud, and see how much else we can fit in to this fine episode of GNU World Order. Okay, so I'm looking at the time, and I see that we're kind of running out of time, but not so much that we can't talk about OwnCloud. Might not get to some of the other stuff, though. But okay, so OwnCloud, something that I heard of actually on my way to the LISA conference, because I had my little Sansa Fuse playing in the car as I was going, and one of the shows that came on was actually a Hacker Public Radio not rerun, but you know, where they play another show on Hacker Public Radio. It was a show that I always listened to anyway, but I hadn't heard this episode yet. Of course, Source Trunk is the name. Source Trunk is probably, honestly, like one of my favorite podcasts ever. As I think I've said before, I think it might have been literally the first podcast I ever heard, back when I first discovered podcasts. Source Trunk somehow came up. I'm sure I was looking for computer-related stuff. And it just really, it's cross-platform, free software. It's a really good show. And the host, Dimitri, is really, really good and funny and clever and smart. So I just love that show. I've been listening to it ever since, and it's funny, he's like on episode, I think, 77. He's been doing the show for, like, forever. So he doesn't do the show all the time, by any means, but he does such a good job on them. And it's got that great theme music that comes on, and I don't know, it's a really comfortable show. If you haven't heard it, go listen to it. Go listen to all of the episodes. It really is one of those shows that has a certain amount of built-in timelessness, because his episodes are about free software projects that typically, they're not going anywhere. So if you hear about it from episode 5, then you might just find that they're still applicable. That if you go to the website that he talks about, you can download the application still, and it's just as good, if not better, than what he was saying on his show. So something to look at. Anyway, most recent episode, he was talking about something called OwnCloud. OwnCloud is somehow related to KDE. I remember seeing the discussion about OwnCloud on the KDE mailing list. I always thought it was interesting. I was excited about it, but I assumed that it was still kind of in alpha mode, not for normal people to check out yet. I had no real idea of where it was in its development. Source Trunk revealed that it was actually quite far along, and that the install was easy. And the more he talked about it, the more I thought, you know, I'm not really into cloud, I don't really care about that stuff, and yet this is really sounding good. Between you and me, the only thing that I really don't like about the cloud is the fact that someone else owns all the clouds that are really kind of out there. You know, the Google cloud. Hey, it's great, it's wonderful, it has Google Docs, whatever, and yet it's not really something I'm interested in committing all my data to Google. It's just not interesting to me. I would not want to do that. There are, of course, other clouds and companies that swear that they have your best interests in mind, and that they would never look at your data, blah, blah, blah. Don't care, not interested. Your own cloud that you run on your own server, now that's a little bit more interesting. Now, as I was speaking to my friend Gort about this, there are, of course, different levels of your quote-unquote, your own server, because here's the server, it's sitting in a data center, it has your name on it, possibly with, like, 10 other people, and, okay, yes, it's your server, it's not the server that you have in your house piping to a dedicated IP address, that kind of thing. So is that your own server? Is that a whole lot different than just committing your stuff to someone else's cloud? It really depends on your level of, like, what you want to actually control. But, I mean, obviously you could do this in that manner. You could buy a tower or grab one from your closet, whatever, slap own cloud on there, and direct some kind of no IP or dynamic DNS kind of thing to that box, and you could have your own cloud that is really sitting in your living room. Or you could do it on a VPS slice at a hosting company, whatever you've got available to you. Either way, you definitely own the software and the infrastructure that is running this cloud. So where is own cloud in terms of development? Well, I think they still claim to be in alpha. It's amazing, though. It's absolutely, I'm not going to go on too much about it because Source Trunk did such a fine job of it. You should just go listen to his review. But let me assure you and reiterate and kind of support what he says. It's amazing. Phenomenal. The install is embarrassingly simple. I mean, I don't know about this kind of thing that much, but like, I mean, if you've ever done a Drupal install, it's pretty easy, right? WordPress install, pretty easy, right? OwnCloud makes those look like rocket science. OwnCloud, literally, I cd'd into var www, I did a get clone gatorius.org/owncloud/owncloud.git. That's it. That's all you do. Then you go to, you know, mygreatwebsite.com/owncloud, and you're just dropped into the create an admin account, and you're up and running. It's that simple. It's astonishing. Now, that said, I did that on a virtual private server that I have access to, and it was literally that easy. On the physical servers that I have running in this building right now, I'm installing OwnCloud on there, and I did have a couple of PHP modules that I hadn't installed, so I needed to do that. I had to add something to an HTXS file for the music files to be seen correctly. Little tiny things like that. Either way, it's just so simple. So easy. It's just, like I say, it's embarrassingly simple. And it is so slick. I saw the thing and my jaw dropped. It was just so easy. It's so slick. It's got a file manager. It's got music. It's got a gallery that you can turn on or off. It's got shared calendaring. Phenomenal. And the thing is, and this is probably a topic for a completely different discussion, but I looked at it and I thought, this is what people are looking for. This is the GUI that people want when you tell them, hey, no problem, upload that file to my server. I don't care if you make a very nice tutorial with lots of screenshots of how to do that with FileZilla, it is still like this huge, for some reason, leap of faith on their part, and this huge learning curve. I don't understand it. I don't pretend to understand it. I will probably never understand it because that's just not me. It's never been me. I do not shy away from new applications or the opportunity to do something new on a computer, so I don't understand the mentality that gets people all scared of when they have to install FileZilla and then learn how to use it. I don't get it. Never will understand it. All the same, it exists. I've seen it. I've come up against it. It's something that I guess we have to deal with. OwnCloud is the answer. I mean, it's insanely cool. You log in, and you can create them a user just like in Drupal. You log in, you're there, you're at your file manager, there's an upload button, there are a list of your files that you can then download or share with other users within the cloud. You can share information from calendars, you can create galleries of your pictures, you can even listen to your music. You can stream your music from OwnCloud into your ears with a click of a button. It's just insanely cool. I don't know how to express how powerful, and I don't mean like how powerful, I mean how emotionally powerful OwnCloud is. People see it and they have no idea that they're not on Facebook or Google or, you know, any other like or iCloud, whatever. It's the answer. It is the answer. It's the free software answer to this concept of a cloud. And if people could grab onto OwnCloud and start installing it on their servers and share it among their friends and build up little communities, then we would decentralize and sort of take back the internet, I think. I really honestly believe that. One little thing about OwnCloud I think would be neat is if they would make the branding a little bit easier. Like if they could just have maybe a folder somewhere, drop your images here, make this your brand, just so that there would be that sort of feeling of decentralization and personalization. So you could say, hey, look, here's my Klaatu Cloud, spelled with a K, cloud. It's clever. You know, and it could have like a picture of a penguin and Klaatu and cloud and then a little cloud graphic, and then people would know, oh, I'm on Klaatu's cloud, and then I could go to someone else's cloud, I could be on Monster B's cloud, or whatever, and that would be neat, I think, but that's a minor gripe, and actually it's pretty easy to do. It's in the core folder, you'll see the images, and there's all the different branding. You can upload your own SVGs and PNGs, and it should drop those images in pretty easily. I've been having weird problems with it, but I think it might be a caching issue of my own creation. Point is, it's great. Point is, you should use it. Point is, you should make sure everyone uses this. This is insane. You can edit documents on it. Google Docs, no need for it anymore. You've got your own cloud. You can edit your Google. You can edit your documents right there. It's just so cool. I can't express it, and I can't even express, well, I can't express, I'm expressing it right now, I'm expressing the importance of OwnCloud, because it's like no joke. The cloud, like it or not, getting popular. It's getting real popular. Something that you're going to want to be ready with a solution. And in fact, I have been waiting for this for about a year now, ever since starting this new job. There's been a demand, you know, sort of a creeping demand for, yeah, we really need a place that we own where we can share calendars, where we can share files, and so on. Looks like that place just arrived. They're at version 2.0 already. I thought they were, like, still in the 0.89 releases or something, but they're really well. They've come, they're there. They're where they need to be. It's fantastic. I can't recommend it enough. There's no excuse not to install it, frankly. It's such an easy install. Just get clone the thing into your web directory, make an admin account, and you're ready to go. It's really, really powerful. I urge you to check this project out. Okay, I'm quickly just completely running out of time, but that's okay. We're just not going to get into my discussion of where to store common files and doing backup things, because that's really a larger discussion, I think, anyway. So I wanted to just mention briefly, and I don't think that this is necessarily something people are going to continually refer back to, but I think it's good to hear, and I think that Acer kind of deserves a little bit of a tip of the hat for this one, because, I was setting up a Fedora machine, an Acer Aspire 1 specifically, which I just recently sold off. with Fedora pre-installed, no less, by request, no less. I know this is really surprising. But yeah, someone wanted a netbook, and they didn't want to use Windows, and so I told them, hey, you should try this thing, this Fedora thing. It's what I'm always talking about. It's what's always on my shirt. And they got really intrigued by it, and some articles that have just recently been released about Kdenlive Live, kind of, that I've been talking about a lot in real life because they're really good articles. And it just kind of all cumulatively started to convince a couple of suckers that this whole GNU Linux thing was a viable solution. Remember how earlier I said I wasn't a very good salesperson? Apparently I'm wrong. So, yeah, two people actually literally have been asking me, hey, my computer's not running that well, or in this particular case, I need a new computer. Period. I need a netbook that I can take with me to Argentina specifically, and I don't want to do the Windows thing. I can work with that. So I was building this Fedora netbook, you know, doing all the installs and stuff like that, which I really ought to talk about at some point, you know, just because I love setting up operating systems for other people. You know, you kind of get to know them, and you're like, okay, I'm going to install this for them. I'll have this pre-installed. I'll grab Celtics for their screenwriting stuff because Emacs, okay, admittedly might be a little bit complex for this person right now. And then you realize that Celtics doesn't have proper installers, so you make a new .desktop file for it, and suddenly it's in your application menu. It's just all so cool. But anyway, I digress. Point being that my first install failed miserably because of a couple of stupid things that I did. And, I mean, I could have undone them and then fixed it, but I was just brand new install. I was like, you know what, screw it. I've taken a couple of wrong turns here. It is going to literally be faster for me at this point to just reinstall Fedora and start over. So I did that. Somewhere along the line, the Acer Aspire 1 got really, really confused as to what it was, and it stopped turning on. This kind of bummed me out because it was going to be something that I was giving to someone, potentially selling it if they liked it, which, again, he did and he paid for. So I thought, wow, this is really weird. This has actually never happened to me before. So not knowing what to do, I turned to the internet. Turns out that BIOS recovery on an Acer Aspire 1, A150 at least, is really, really easy. And you might be thinking, Klaatu, I know, I've done a million BIOS recoveries. Well, I haven't. I've never done that before. I don't know what a BIOS is. I don't know how to recover it. The computers I'm familiar with, you hold down a certain key combination when you're starting up, you clear out the non-volatile RAM. If that doesn't work, you do a couple of other things. That's just how it's done. I didn't know what to do. So for the BIOS thing, apparently I needed to reflash the BIOS. I've flashed many a chip in my time. I wasn't too concerned about that. I was a little bit nervous, however, as to whether I was going to need Windows or DOS for this to happen, because I've never done it, and I don't know what's involved, and I think I've heard about some things that, yeah, you need, you know, you have to boot into Windows or DOS in order to do this flash thing. Happily, and this is why I really wanted to mention this, Acer has a BIOS flasher that does not require any of that stuff. So I didn't have to touch Windows or DOS or anything like that. It was very simple. And just for posterity, here's how it is done. And of course, you would just as easily be able to look this up on the internet if you really need it, but I'm going to go through it really quickly. You create a FAT. MS-DOS FAT volume on a thumb drive, for instance. It does not need to be bootable. It doesn't need to be anything fancy. It just needs to be a FAT volume. Make DOSFS --n space, you know, rescue disk or whatever, /dev/SDB or wherever your thumb drive is located, which, of course, you'd find out from dmessage pipe tail. So you do that, and then you mount the thumb drive as a normal drive on your system. You download the latest BIOS version from Acer, and they have that located at ftp.work.acer-euro.com/netbooks/aspire_1_150/BIOS. Go in there, find the latest version, and you download it. You can extract the zip archive to the thumb drive, unzip v.3114.zip. -d to set the directory that you're going to unzip it to, /media/rescue disk. And then you rename the BIOS file. This sounded completely wrong to me, because I thought, surely this instruction on the internet telling me to rename the file is old and outdated. I don't know why I thought that, but I didn't do that the first time, and sure enough, it didn't work. So you have to rename it. You have to rename the BIOS file to ZG5IA32.FD. That's just what you have to do. I don't know why. It's what the BIOS flasher wants to see. It doesn't matter what version of BIOS you just downloaded. It's just, you need to call it that one file. Seems really weird to me. It seems like a smart program would simply look for asterisk.fd and assume that was the flashable image and it would use that, but apparently that's not how they did it. But who am I to complain? This is working without Windows and without DOS. I don't care. So then you turn off your Aspire if it was already on, and then you verify that both your battery and your AC adapter are plugged in, and then you start it up whilst holding the FN key and the escape key down. While you're pressing that, you know, you hold those down, you press the power button. Momentarily, you'll see the power button blink, and then you press the power button once to, I guess, confirm that, yes, I really want to do this. You can release the FN and the escape key, and then the BIOS will be flashed. And that's it. Once it's finished, it only takes like a couple of moments. It will reboot. I think it rebooted automatically. Yeah, it did. And then it starts up like normal, and you're good to go. So, you know, if someone by chance from Acer is listening to my little internet show, thank you, Acer, for making that possible, and not requiring Windows or DOS or any such thing as that. Honestly, I mean, that's just great. You should never have to use proprietary software just to flash. I mean, the BIOS, I'm sure, is proprietary. But in order to flash the hardware that you purchased and make it work again, you should not need Windows or DOS, even FreeDOS. It's just not right. So the fact that this is a self-contained little flashable thing, that was very, very cool. It worked like a charm, and the Acer was back up and running in no time. And then I reinstalled Fedora and did all the cool stuff that I like to do, and sold it off to someone. Gave it a good home, finally, because it wasn't really getting used all that much by me. That's about it. And I think that's about it for the show, too. So thanks for listening. I'm, of course, Klaatu. You can find the show at GNUWorldOrder.info. Wait, what? Yes, I got a new domain. It's called GNUWorldOrder.info. This is, once again, huge thanks to The Last Known God, former forum admin for Linux Reality, now, like, basically the big sponsor for GNU World Order, Unix Porn, or Unix Puppies, whichever you prefer, and probably a couple of other things that I've got going on. So, really big thanks to him. So no more thebadapples.info. That's deprecated. It's gone. Remove it. Remove it from all your bookmarks. Remove it from your memory. Pretend like it was never there. It's GNUWorldOrder.info. Someone asked me, why info? Because it was cheap. It was like $2. So GNUWorldOrder.info, that's the site. You can reach me at Klaatu at hackrepublicradio.org or Klaatu at member.fsf.org. You can also find me on Freenode in IRC, channels Oddcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, OpenMolar, Open Source Positions, lots of different places. My nick on there is Not Klaatu, and coincidentally, Not Klaatu on Jabber as well. Jabber.org is my IM network, so Not Klaatu on there. That's about it. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time.